Yesterday, we had some questions. Today, some macroeconomic answers for the White House and others. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 11th of May, Thursday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. While the imbroglio over the firing of the now former director of the FBI, James Comey, continues to play out in political Washington, we are going to take a detour to the global economy. Interestingly enough, featuring the same central actor. The Economist published an interview with President Trump today in which the following exchange took place as the conversation turned to deficit spending and the president's tax plan. What you're about to hear, I should say, is lightly edited for broadcast. You understand the expression prime the pump, the president asked. The editor of The Economist, the one doing the interview, said yes, she does indeed know what priming the pump is. And then the president went on, quote, have you heard that expression used before? Because I haven't heard it. I mean, I came up with it a couple of days ago and I thought it was good. It's what you have to do. So, about that. One of those last two statements isn't true. The other one is debatable at best. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with which is which.
So, for the record, Donald Trump did not invent the phrase priming the pump in an economic context, or really any context.
Pump priming goes back all the way to the 1930s.
Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster.
We do have evidence of, for example, FDR using it during the Great Depression, talking about his own policies.
In the olden days, like hundreds of years ago, you'd have to put some water into a pump to get it started. In economics, it's a similar idea. Larry Summers teaches economics at Harvard.
A burst of government spending or a burst of tax cutting can start there being more spending, which leads to more income, and the economy starts revving up.
But the thing is, says Summers, is that this metaphor is usually used when the economy is in the dumps, not in a situation like we have now with 4.5% unemployment and strong corporate profits.
Pretty unusual to talk about priming a pump when the pump has been actively pumping water for a long time.
The other thing is that priming the pump is more of a phrase that Democrats would use.
It is an odd phrase for a Republican president to use.
Chris Edwards is an economist with the Cato Institute. Democrats would use it to describe stimulus plans, increasing spending or cutting personal income taxes.
Trump's tax plan is generally a supply-side tax reform plan.
That means it focuses on cutting business taxes and deregulation. That usually has a different and contested metaphor, trickle-down. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
One more thing from that Economist interview on the topic of China and its currency. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was in the room, and as the president talked about his relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping and how it has led, among other things, to, in the president's mind, China no longer devaluing its currency, Mnuchin said, right, as soon as the president got elected, they went the other way. That's a quote talking about the currency. That is two things about what Mnuchin said. Number one, Secretary Mnuchin was a partner at Goldman Sachs. He has run a hedge fund, and he is deeply experienced in the global economy. Number two, what he said simply isn't true. China has actually been propping up the renminbi, its currency, since 2014, three-something years ago. All right, moving on. The Trumpian trade agenda got a shot in the arm today. The Senate has confirmed Robert Lighthizer as the U.S. trade representative. Mr. Lighthizer is going to have his hands full, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reminds us.
Robert Lighthizer worked under the U.S. Trade Representative during the Reagan administration, and more recently he's worked outside of government as a lawyer to push for better trade treatment for U.S. industries like manufacturing and high tech. A key role he'll likely play in the Trump administration, going back to the negotiating table with Canada and Mexico on NAFTA.
The president has to have a U.S. trade representative in place. He notifies the Congress, and it has 60 days to specify negotiating objectives.
Economist Peter Morici at the University of Maryland says that could include things like updating NAFTA to deal with financial services and digital commerce.
He brings back to Congress his package, and they have to give it an up or down vote.
This is what's referred to as fast-track trade authority to prevent Congress from adding multiple amendments to help specific industries, bogging down the process. President Trump already has fast-track authority through at least 2018. Caroline Freund at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says in renegotiating free trade deals, the new trade representative is likely to take a harder line than his predecessors.
Lighthizer hasn't been so interested in trade liberalization agreements, so agreements where we lower trade barriers to other countries and they lower their trade barriers to us, so we have free trade between us.
And she says he might well expand trade enforcement to punish countries for dumping products like steel and textiles on the U.S. market. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, that could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, drug overdoses are now the number one cause of injury-related deaths in this country, opioids mostly. And one unpleasant reality of that, apart from the obvious one, is that morgues and medical examiners are being overwhelmed. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that one.
It was several years ago when David Madfus and his wife Tanya were walking home after enjoying a late dinner in San Francisco. They were crossing the street about one block from their house when a truck making a left-hand turn hit them.
I fell on my shoulder. My wife fell and hit her head on the street and suffered severe brain trauma.
Madfus's wife Tanya died a week later, but it would take 6 months more before a death certificate was complete. During that time, Madfus was unable to receive pension benefits from his wife's four retirement accounts.
And so when those retirement programs, we had survivor benefit option, and they would not accept the death certificate that said pending.
Madfus's case wasn't unique. At one point last year, the L.A. County Morgue had a backlog of 180 bodies due to understaffing. As overdose deaths skyrocket across the country, toxicology tests, which used to take a month or two, are now regularly taking a half a year, tying up funerals, insurance payouts, and criminal cases.
When you look at the numbers of people dying from drug overdose deaths, it does now exceed the number of people dying in car crashes.
Rose Rudd is a health scientist with the Centers for Disease Control. The reason for the increase, she says, is a growing addiction to opioid-based painkillers, as well as increased use of new deadly synthetic opioids.
In 1999, there was about 8,000 people in the United States that died from a drug overdose involving an opioid. And in 2015, there was over 33,000 drug overdose deaths that involved an opioid.
The term opioids refers to a family of drugs including morphine, oxycodone, and heroin. But while heroin is generally about four times the potency of morphine, synthetic opioids such as fentanyl or carfentanyl are much stronger.
These are two cases in progress, basically just little tiny packets of white and tan powder.
Brandon Jones is the lead chemist at the Washington, D.C. drug lab. In front of him, heroin confiscated by police has tested positive for furanylfentanyl, an opioid synthetic 100 times more potent than heroin.
Even a small amount, like less than a milligram, can actually just kill somebody straight outright.
And because overdoses occur in such smaller amounts, Jones says detecting them in toxicology tests is much more difficult. Dr. Brian Peterson is the president of the National Association of Medical Examiners. He says many doctors are already working at the upper limit of the number of autopsies they're allowed per year.
While there are maybe 500 or 600 forensic pathologists working in the country these days, we could use at least twice that many.
In addition to a supply shortage of doctors, Peterson says the increased number of overdoses also mean more time spent testifying in criminal cases.
That means more time in court. And of course, if you're in court, you can't be doing autopsies. So eventually, it's more work being extracted from the same small pool of people.
The state of Maryland recently added $400,000 to increase salaries for examiners forced to work longer hours. One county in Ohio even borrowed an air-conditioned mass casualty trailer to relieve a lack of space at the morgue. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A story now about what might be called the innovator's dilemma. You invent something, you build a company around it, you go public to great fanfare, and then somebody bigger and stronger comes in and does the same doggone thing. Today's loser in that category, Snap. In its very first quarterly profit report as a public company last night after the bell, well, not only does the parent company of Snapchat not have any profits, but it doesn't have enough users either. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth explains what's going on.
I reached out to the foremost Snapchat expert I know.
Hi.
My niece, Dea Verghese. She's 25 and she loves Snap. Nobody calls it Snapchat, but she says her friends are bailing.
Most people have moved to Instagram stories. I have some, like, best friends that don't even look at my Snap stories anymore because they just never use it.
That's exactly what Wall Street wonders. Is Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, beating Snap at its own game? Snap did add 8 million new users this quarter, but that's a million below what analysts expected.
Snap is not in a great position to grow. I don't know how it's going to grow.
Peter Cohen at Babson College says Snapchat's features were once new and exciting. Who doesn't want dog ears on their selfie? But the competition has now copied Snap's whole story thing.
Facebook has 200 million daily users of Instagram stories, which is beating Snapchat's popular function.
Snap has 166 million, even though they invented stories. Analyst Dennis Gartman says Instagram and Facebook already have the users Snapchat wants. To him, Snap looks like an acquisition target, even though Snap rejected Facebook's offer in 2013.
Google and Facebook are like two large monsters that seem to be able to gobble up almost everything in their path, and my bet is that the same thing happens here.
But JMP analyst Ron Josey says the copycats just help more potential users understand what Snapchat is. If Snap doesn't add users fast, he sees another path.
Can they continue to drive even more engagement with the users that they have? We think they can.
More highly engaged users could help Snap sell ads at higher rates. That means getting Snap fans like my niece to post 10 times a day instead of 5. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the thing that I really worry about is that it will cease to be a good thing and it'll just be a money-making thing, and then all will be lost.
Not your average CEO, let me tell you that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 23 points today, about a 10%, 20,919. NASDAQ down 13 points, 0.2%, 6,115. The S&P 500 off 5 points, also about 0.2%, 2,394. Way worse at the opening bell, but they staggered back. So we were telling you about Snapchat. Shares down 21% today. Facebook, owner of Instagram, down a 10%. Twitter, down about 0.8% today. There does not appear to be a bright light at the end of the shopping aisle for Macy's. The department store reported another quarter of falling sales. Shares down 17%. Retailers grappling with the same kinds of things. Nordstrom rang down 7.5%. JCPenney down 7.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.41%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's illegal by federal statute for property renters to be discriminated against, not for race, national origin, children, nothing. And yet, of course, it happens. So Seattle is trying something new, as Eilish O'Neill reports.
Hey.
Hi.
Yeah, normally we go on the back door, but it's so hard to find if you don't know where it is.
Well, come on in.
Jessa Lewis and her 14-year-old daughter share a two-bedroom basement apartment with another mom and her daughter. Lewis says they all live together in part because it's really hard for single moms to find an apartment to rent.
My daughter and I were looking for a place to live in her school district. And I called a number that was posted and she said, well, it's a small apartment. I said, that's fine. It's just my daughter and I. She said, well, then I'm not even going to consider you.
Things like this happen all the time in Seattle, says City Council member Lisa Herbold.
People of color are being discriminated against. People based on their family size, on their gender. Approximately 60% of fair housing testing has some evidence of bias found.
That's why Herbold proposed a new law to try to give renters like Lewis a shot at living where they want. It's called the first-in-time rule. The law took effect this January, and the city says it will start enforcing it in July. Here's how it works. Landlords publish the criteria for renting a unit. Things like proof of income, a certain credit score or rental history, positive references from past landlords.
Landlords have to tell tenants what the baseline qualifications are and when somebody applies and meets them, the landlord must offer the unit to that person.
In other words, it's first come, first served. The first person who meets the landlord's own criteria gets the apartment. But landlords say the law's much too broad.
The city council, I think, is managing to the lowest common denominator.
I meet Beth Byland outside one of the three houses she rents in North Seattle.
Instead of going after the landlords that are horrible and mistreating people, they're putting us all in kind of a sack.
That's why Byland joined other landlords to sue the city over the new rule. The lawsuit claims the ordinance is unconstitutional because it takes away property owners' right to choose their tenants and to exclude unwanted people from their property. Ethan Blevins, the lawyer on the case, says the law hurts renters by encouraging landlords to come up with onerous rental criteria.
One of our clients says his rental criteria is several pages now and makes it harder for people to be able to satisfy that criteria, specifically young individuals and arguably the very people that Seattle wants to help, vulnerable populations.
Furthermore, Blevins adds, the new law still gives some renters an advantage. If they have a car to zip around and check out apartments, internet access at home to make it easier to submit applications, or a flexible schedule to apply for units as they come on the market. Blevins says existing anti-discrimination laws were sufficient, but Councilmember Herbold says Seattle's complaint-based system
can't really address these broader, more what I see as sort of systemic issues around how people process rental applications. The ordinance itself is intended to legislate a process so that people will not inadvertently break the law.
Housing advocates say other cities will look to Seattle to see how successful the new rule is and how the lawsuit turns out. In Seattle, I'm Alicia Neal for Marketplace.
There are CEO interviews, and then there are CEO interviews. Sometimes they stick to their talking points, sometimes they throw a bunch of numbers at you, and then sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, they actually talk. This one you're about to hear, it's one of those. Glenn Kelman is the CEO of Redfin. Regular listeners will know the company's chief economist, Neela Richardson, is one of our Friday stalwarts. Anyway, Mr. Kelman came into the studio the other day, and for those of you not familiar with Redfin and what it does, well, that's where we started. What do you tell people when you go to dinner parties and you say, I'm the CEO of Redfin, and they say, what?
I say, how could you not know about Redfin?
We're a technology-powered real estate broker, so the idea is to help people buy and sell homes, but to use technology to make it better and more efficient.
Explain that a little bit.
It means you save half the commission. It means that you get better service because your agent can get you into a home on a moment's notice. It's sort of like Uber or Lyft for real estate. Hmm. It's not a pure software company, and it's not a pure real estate brokerage. It was sort of hard to get funded because most people want you to be one or the other. But now I think there's a real movement in Silicon Valley to support these kinds of businesses. They create different kinds of jobs, but they also attack much larger opportunities.
So let's talk actually about a couple of things that you rolled into that answer. First of all, you mentioned Uber and Lyft, but your employees are actually your employees as opposed to whatever Uber and Lyft drivers are, because that's still sort of up in the air, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you hire them and they're full-time employees.
We employ thousands of real estate agents. We offer them health care and salary. We give them an opportunity to earn stock options, and they're totally different than the people I'd worked with throughout the rest of my career. I was used to computer scientists from Stanford and MIT and Harvard, and it's been the best thing that ever happened to me. But I also think it's been a really good thing to happen to America, because technology companies shouldn't just benefit a few graduates from a few universities with computer science degrees or math degrees or something like that. It should benefit everyone. It should make things better for the consumer, but it should also make things better for the people doing the work.
So let me ask you then, getting to the consumer for a second, how come real estate has not been, I'm going to make up a word here, electronicized the way travel has, right? I mean, I can't tell you the last time I spoke to an actual person in buying an airplane ticket.
Yeah.
But, you know, housing and real estate, you still have to do that.
Well, we're working on it.
I was just going to say, despite your best efforts.
So there's a number of factors. The first is that it's a cooperative industry. So there's one agent listing the house. There's another agent who's representing a buyer. And the two of those folks have to cooperate. So if you're trying to disrupt that market, you're working with another real estate agent who is not interested in being disrupted. And who can blame it? I think that's part of it. And then the other part of it is that the consumer buys a house once every 7 years. So it's an infrequent purchase. People tend to be risk averse. But I think that's finally changing. If you look at the numbers, about $500 million went into real estate technology in 2013. $3 billion went into real estate technology this year. And so we're seeing this consensus on Wall Street and everywhere along Sand Hill Road and in between.
Yeah, where all the VCs are, the venture capitalists.
Yes, yeah. That real estate is changing, that the fees are going to come down and that there's a better way to do things, that consumers deserve better service and they probably can use technology to get a better deal.
Are you guys still a startup? Would you say that?
You know, Jeff Bezos just wrote a letter to shareholders about how it's still day one, and I think it's day 25 years for Amazon. And I love that mentality. You know, even though we've got a couple of thousand people, we're competing against folks who have way more money than we do, have way more numbers of real estate agents and listings and everything else. So we just got to be tougher and scrappier than everybody else, or we're going to die.
What was interesting about that Bezos letter, the CEO of Amazon, of course, is that he said if you start acting like it's day two, that's therein lies ruin.
Absolutely. I don't want to get too philosophical about it, but there's this novel, Love in the Time of Cholera, and at the end of it, they say, how long can we keep going up this goddamn river? Mm-hmm. And the hero says, forever. And that's how I feel about Redfin. You're not going to be able to put that on the radio, are you?
Yes, we are. We have a little thing. We go,
a beeper?
Yeah, you bet.
Good.
No, it's a good line. We're totally using it. Are you guys profitable yet?
No.
Seems to be a problem.
Yes. I wouldn't say that it's a problem if you're growing as fast as we are in a market that's as large as we are. So we still have to be financially disciplined in a different way than Google or Facebook because we still employ real people to help sell these houses. It's a tough and dirty business crawling around the attic to see if there's rat traps in there and see if the house is clean.
I don't know if this will come across on the air, but you are a... And I say this not pejoratively, I hope. You're a quirky dude, man.
What did I do wrong?
You didn't do anything wrong.
But, I just want to tell you, my wife worships you. I told her I was going to meet you, and she said, don't be that way.
No, it's
and
great.
And I hung up the phone. Bridget, like, is calling me, and I've got my wife online, too, and she says, don't be that way. And I never found out what she meant.
No.
Now she's going to say.
No, this is great, because it goes to the point. Which is this, you say what you think, and you are effusive and engaged about the mission of your company, which I will tell you from personal experience, not everybody who sits in that chair as a CEO is.
You know, if somebody were more passionate about Redfin, how would she not be more qualified to have my job than I am? Like, that's the thing I have to be the best at. I can be dumber than other people who work at Redfin. I can be screwed up in all sorts of ways, but if I actually care less than someone else, how could I possibly qualify to be the CEO? That's how I feel about it. And it's not manufactured. I really feel about it. And let me explain a little bit about this. So I started a software company with a couple other folks, went public. We made plenty of money. And I thought it was this incredible mission. But in fact, we sold software to Halliburton. We sold software to Frito-Lay and Pepsi and all these companies that didn't necessarily do good things. And at the end of it, all these people who I thought were my brothers in arms, who I thought we were doing something beautiful, actually, it was just all about the money. And the deal that I made with my family and myself is that I was never going to do that again. And Redfin, you know, it's a business that has hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. It's doing great in lots of different ways. But the thing that I really worry about is that it will cease to be a good thing and it'll just be a money-making thing. And then all will be lost. Because eventually, if you're not a good thing, consumers aren't going to want to work with you. Employees aren't going to want to work with you. Investors probably will. But you really have to be that thing. Otherwise, it just all collapses sooner or later. And so there's this argument that you have to put shareholder value first. And nobody realizes that to do that, you have to put what you really believe in first.
We're done. Glenn Kelman.
Okay.
CEO of Redfin.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Told you pretty good, right? Bridget, by the way, Bridget Bonner, she's a producer on that piece. There was, believe it or not, more to that interview than we could fit into 6 minutes and 30 seconds. You can hear it on our Corner Office podcast.
This final note on the way out today, one very last thing from that Economist interview with President Trump. They got to talking about healthcare. Hat tip for spotting this, by the way, goes to Sarah Cliff at Vox. But they got to talking about healthcare and the insurance market, the Economist and the president. And the president said this, insurance is, and this is a quote, insurance is you're 20 years old, you just graduated from college, and you start paying $15 a month for the rest of your life. And by the time you're 70 and you really need it, you're still paying the same amount. And that's really insurance. End of quote. $15 a month, he said. All right, we got to go. Everything on Wall Street today down about a 10%, maybe 0.2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy. All right, not everything on Wall Street, just the major indices. Anyway, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for the time being is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.